Welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 608. I'm Jim McDowell. I'll be talking about the MotoGP races from Barcelona. And to talk about those races, I need to have someone to chat at. And with me tonight is Derek Cabrera. How you doing, Derek?
I am doing good, Jim. How are you?
We're good. Lots of rain here. We're going to float away, or I'm going to have to build an ark, one or the other. It doesn't seem to want to stop raining. So it prevents a lot of good motorcycle riding and racing here from happening. Everything's being postponed and canceled because of the rain. But there's not much we can do about controlling Mother Nature.
Have you been looking to go ride or race anything lately? Or
no, not just wanting to ride, just go ride with my boy. And it's just so wet, so muddy, and he's not up for that yet. He's just not there. So,
yeah,
and I'm not
sure.
Too. I did that when I was 13, 14, 15. I don't want to sit around washing bikes all the time now.
So. Yeah, for but sure. That's no, in the Northeast, it's been gross as well. So, though I do have to say before we get into it, this past weekend I was able to go up to New Hampshire to watch the American Flat Track racing, and those boys go fast. That was some great racing to watch. But yeah, I don't know. I just wanted to add that in. That's pretty cool.
Yeah,
that was the motorcycle racing highlight of my weekend, besides the actual MotoGP races.
Yeah, I saw your Instagram and some cool videos from there. A lot of the old memories stirred up there. Been wanting to go to the half mile at Lima, which is about 45 minutes away from my house. So I plan on going up there and catching a little American flat track.
Yeah, man. Yeah, these guys were just on like a super short track, so I'd love to see them do a full mile. That'd be crazy.
Oh, mile's amazing to watch. Yeah, it's very, very interesting to watch. The speed and how close they are is really something to behold.
Yeah. So that was my real life motorcycle racing action this weekend. It's pretty cool. I actually got to talk to some of the riders. They have like a really cool open pit area, and you can really just get up and talk to a lot of the privateers and even the factory riders that are there signing autographs and talking to people. So that's pretty cool. But there was some Grand Prix action this weekend. One of the jewels in the crown of MotoGP, the Catalunya race.
Yes, that's true. But first, we're going to have to thank some donators for donating to the show. We're going to thank Joshua Tutel, James DiPietro, Keith Kovac, Nick Saban, Scott Saunter, Alan Fleming, Andy Miller, David Johnson, Gary Chavat, Jamund Mel, Carl Marsh, Lester NG, Peter Newell, Steve, and Warren Pond. Thank you guys so much for donating to the show. It really helps us to keep up the website, the hosting fees, and gets Dave out to the races at BSB to get those great interviews that he gets. So if you feel like it, please help out. You can do that by going to our webpage, www.motopodcast.com, donate button on the left-hand side. You can do it by PayPal or by Patreon at patreon.com/motopod. So with that, we are going to get into a little bit of listener feedback. And this is one of the things I truly love about the Motopod community. Skylar puts out there, hey, haven't heard from you guys. And what do? We get some great emails that have come in this week. Really want to say a special thank you to Dave Jevons. He has been touring Europe. He got to go to Mugello. He was a guest of Grassini there. And he was also able to go to the race in Barcelona as a guest of Petronas Yamaha. His had some very cool videos that he sent us. He was in turn 10 where all the action was happening at the race this weekend. Really awesome video. He was standing on the outside of the approach to turn 10, right up against the wall, and that was some really cool video there, Dave. Thank you very much for all that, and thank you for taking the time to write those emails and sending them in to us. Also with listener feedback is a email from Keith Kovac. He states, hi guys. I wanted your opinion on the state of Yamaha and MotoGP. I have a few questions on the topic. Do you guys think there will be a lineup change at Yamaha next season? To me, I see Rossi being the one to step aside if Yamaha cannot give him the bike he needs to be competitive. He honestly just looks lost. If that were the case, do you think that Quartararo should get the seat, leaving the Petronas seat to possibly Lorenzo if he continues to suffer at Honda? Personally, I am biased towards Fabio. I think he has proven a lot of people wrong and has achieved far more than expected. Looking forward to hearing your opinions on the subject. Glad to be a subscriber to a great show. Well, Keith, thank you very much. It's our pleasure to bring you the show, and we appreciate people like you who are subscribers. Derek, I'll let you go with it. What do you think? When does Rossi step aside?
I definitely don't think he steps aside next year. I think he finishes out his contract. And, you know, I honestly don't think he knows if he's going to continue on. I think he's definitely frustrated with the state of play with the Yamaha. But as we the Yamaha was competitive this weekend. Quartararo showed it. Vinales and Rossi showed it in the opening couple laps. And even in qualifying, I think there were we'll get to it more in depth. But, you know, there's four Yamahas in the top two rows. So they were reasonably competitive. And while I do think Fabio is going to be the next step of Yamaha's future, I think Rossi is there as long as he wants to be there. And only he knows how long that's going to be. But I certainly don't see him just stepping away after the end of the season.
Okay. I look into Rossi's eyes. And one reason that you race a motorcycle or you're around this is because that is the passion that burns deep inside of you. And the only thing that tends to put out that fire that burns inside you is uncompetitiveness, and the which leads you to, or the goalpost has been moved, let's say. And I think Rossi is starting to get to that point. His frustration with Yamaha, I think, is evident in his face. He will, of course, see out his contract, and he will race next year. But I would not be surprised to see him say at the end of 2020 that he's done. Now, if Yamaha gives him a very competitive bike, he's at the front and vying for wins, then he may consider signing like a one-year extension onto his contract. I can't see Rossi racing much farther than 42 years old. I just think the body at some point will tend to give out. You're just getting old, and father time catches up with every one of us. With Quartararo, he's the hot hand right now, and he's definitely making good use of the Yamaha, and he's showing everybody the potential that this young gentleman has. Is it going to be sustainable? I don't really know yet. But it sure looks like Quartararo is going to be at the front or near the front here consistently based on what he's shown us. If I'm Yamaha, I definitely put him on a long-term contract. If it means he has to stay at Petronas Yamaha, I'm okay. I would be okay with that. However, there would be a clause in that contract that says that Quartararo gets a full factory bike come 2020, and he doesn't get a hand-me-down bike. So that's how I see it.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many ways it could go. Like you said, I think Yamaha is going to be silly if they don't have Quartararo in the future. Even more so than Maverick Vinales, because I think he can see that he's frustrated as well. But yeah, it all kind of comes back to the contract game, right?
Like, yeah,
they sign these contracts one whole year before they even do anything, and I feel like if Vinales, you know, right, so last year, 2 years ago, or whenever they signed the contract, he signed it, and then, like, halfway through that season, the Yamaha just totally uncompetitive. And that would have definitely changed his opinion of where he wants to go, but now he's there until the end of next year. So, I don't know, it's that whole thing is pretty, it's kind of one big loop, you know, contracts and making sure that people have other places to go. So I don't know, somewhat unrelated, but also kind of gets me going, is they should have a transfer window. They should have, like, after August, they can start talking about contracts or whatever. Cause like it got ridiculous this year. And now we're seeing riders on bikes that are either uncompetitive or maybe they would think about going elsewhere. But yeah, anyway, a little bit of a tangent for me, but kind of on the same line of, you know, contracts. And yeah, Quartararo, he's fast. He should be on Yamaha. If they're smart, like they have been, they're going to give him a bike, unlike Zarco, where they were just like, oh, sorry, you're out of luck. So
Yeah,
that's me.
Yeah, I see it. I mean, you know, Quartararo, definitely the talent, definitely the up and the comer. Morbidelli is definitely no slouch either. I mean, to me, the shocking thing out of all of this is the fact that both those two guys on the Petronas Yamahas are going really fast, and the factory team can't seem to figure out how to go fast on the same bikes or very close to the same bikes. I can't help but wonder if Yamaha is caught in a problem of the past and the future. You know, Rossi remembers how that bike was, where Vinales knows how it is and wants to go to a different direction to satisfy his riding style. Then you have Morbidelli and Quartararo, who have no concept of what a MotoGP bike should be like or how it handles or any past reference for how a Yamaha actually is. So they don't know or care. They're just racing the wheels off of what they've been given. So that kind of ties into the whole when does Rossi quit? Well, maybe Yamaha's got to really think about, unfortunately, kicking Rossi to the side of the road so that they can push the development in one direction. I don't know. It's complete speculation on my point, but that's how I see it.
And with that, unless there's any other feedback, which there is not, I think we can get into the weekend and kind of get lost in what happened there.
Sure. So if we go to Moto3 qualifying, interesting that Suzuki, Minho, Arenas, and Ogura all come out of the Q1 session to go to Q2. Rodrigo wound up on pole position. It was interesting that they had tried to figure out who was going to have a dance partner. They're all timing things down to the last second before they would go out of the pits. And Rodrigo actually left so late that he couldn't get around to actually get a lap time in. The counter had gone to zero. Again, we've talked about this before a little bit, Skylar and myself, and I'll get your thoughts on it, Derek. These Moto3 guys are not back timing things correctly, or they're not understanding how to play that waiting game. And it's starting to cause a little bit of confusion and chaos inside of these qualifying sessions. So I'm, you know, to me, I would think it's not that hard to figure it takes you X amount of time to complete a lap on cool tires. Here's how you're going to go at it, and this is what you're going to do. So, you know, it seems really weird that they would have a problem that bad. I don't think they'll ever have that problem again with Ed Gersini, but it didn't hurt Rodrigo because nobody else could put down a time that was faster than what he already had. So he wound up on with the pole position. Ogura was second quickest, then Arbolino, Suzuki, Canet, Arenas, Lopez, Masia, and De La Porta ninth with McPhee, who did not have a great qualifying session, shockingly, finishing there in 10th. However, though, the spread was only a tenth and a half between all those guys. So anything else you want to put in there for qualifying, Derek?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, I think we've harped on it before a little bit. It's just it's not only is it the rider's issue when they're cruising and waiting for the toe and then not getting around, but it's the team's issue as well. And, you know, there's a lot of established teams this year alone that have gotten caught out, like the Snipers team with Bonatti mm-hmm. in Qatar, I think, you didn't get around. And I think it's just down to people looking for toes and either riders not wanting to give them or, you know, riders just waiting. So I think they've done a pretty good job with the new Q1, Q2 format, though. It kind of eliminates a lot of that, but it still happens just because of the nature of the class, and especially at a circuit with a really long straight like that. So, yeah. But yeah, that's pretty much it as far as the qualifying session goes. Right. I mean, it's standard Moto3.
Yes. The only other thing for me that I was thinking is like Binder was 16th there in qualifying. I'm not too sure. Binder has always been near the front, but doesn't seem like he can qualify very well here of late. It just isn't going anywhere.
I think Moto3 is
it could be just that tight.
even, well, it's one, it's that tight, but two, it's showing it really doesn't matter where you qualified. Like, you can qualify 25th and you still have a shot to win the race. Like, it like truly doesn't matter. And it's great for us fans as a spectacle, because you can see, like, this week, it was Antonelli, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where did he end up qualifying?
Antonelli was they never posted a time in the session, but they technically, yeah, he started 17th on the grid.
17th on the grid, and he was leading the race at one point, right? He got bumped out a little bit, but mm-hmm. still, like, you know, it I feel like it truly doesn't matter where you qualify in Moto 3 anymore, just because the bikes are so evenly matched and the toe is such an important thing. As mm-hmm. long as you get away in that front group and you don't get caught up in any incidents, you have a shot to be on the podium every week. Yep. So again, that's why, like, it's funny that the most drama in qualifying happens in Moto 3, but it really determines the least amount in as far as your overall position for the race. It definitely gets you out of harm's way to be further up the grid, but it doesn't matter that much.
No, truly it doesn't. So with that, let's go on to the actual race that happened in Moto 3. So as it started out, it's typical Moto 3 spots. I guess we should take the fact that Masia, Faggia, Salak, Minio, Masaki, and Antonelli, they actually all received 12 grid spots back for irresponsible riding. Again, this whole everybody looking for the toe and trying to find a dance partner had them dawdling on the racing line. So Race Direction gave them grid penalties of 12 places each. It is interesting then that as things started off, the usual players are sort of out front and you had that long train. But what caught my eye was the fact that Anshu was near the front. He was in that lead pack, and I think that's the first time we've seen this kid be that close to the front. And I was expecting big things out of him at the beginning. But then, you know, what happens? You know, you had McPhee, who had started 10th. He was up, and he had a great ride going. He was in at the front. And that lead train, you know, was made up of about 17 to 18 riders. And then we get to the massive crash that happens, which was caused by Anshu. They were going into turn 4, and Anshu, I don't know what he did. I don't know if he just misjudged the braking point or he just got a little excited because he was at the front or in that lead group and he was wanting to show what he could do with the bike. But he winds up taking Arrhenius out, and he knocked Arrhenius down. Arrhenius had an amazingly horrifying looking crash. He bounced like a rag doll, and each time he would bounce off the ground, he would spin maybe two or three rotations and then hit the ground again into the gravel trap. Of course, when Anshu barreled in there, it became like bowling for riders with everybody going everywhere. And basically, Arrhenius was down in the gravel. Perez, Salak, Fernandez, Garcia, Anshu, they were all over there. And, you know, Anshu had that moment. He couldn't recover it. And then, you know, he just plows into everybody. That's what you got to learn. That's racing in a pack. And, you know, I'm not so sure that he's quite mastered that part of it yet. Your thoughts, Derek?
Yeah, I mean, I think he knows this track really well. He was in the European Championship last year. He's been here for Rookies Cup. I think his brother last week set the fastest outright Moto 3 time up until that point. So it's like he's been here before. He knows what's up. I think KTM got a new fairing or something. So maybe some small parts updates. So yeah, he was doing well. But like you said, he's still super young. He's the exception to the rule to be able to. I think he's what, 15?
I think he's still 15. I don't think he'll be 16 until we get near San Marino or something like that, I believe.
Yeah, so he's still that exception that, you know, when the Junior World Championship or when the Rookies Cup and they will make an exception for you. But yeah, I mean, he's still truly a kid. So yeah, I don't think he has the racecraft yet. You know, big groups Even in the Rookies Cup and in the European Championship, he dominated those championships and probably really didn't spend time in those massive, massive groups that we see in Moto 3. So yeah, I totally agree. You know, it's just a unfortunate incident.
Yeah, it was. So as the race progressed from that point, you had sort of the normal guys that were left out front. Canet was there. Lopez was there. Of course, this is the first time we've seen Lopez really at the front. He kind of broke in as a wild card in Jerez 2 years ago, I think, and looked really good. He hasn't done much since, but this time he was at the front, near the front, looking good.
Didn't Lopez last year almost get on the podium in Moto 3?
I think he did, and he's been close to it.
Or because he was supposed to be on the podium, and then he ran off track too many times, and then they pulled his podium from under him, and he just like lost it in the pit lane after, or in his box after the race. And I don't think that was this year. It was
I think it was last year
that happened. But yeah, he's shown moments of brilliance. But yeah, this race was the first time in a while that he's been up there.
Yeah, first, and it was looking good. I mean, those guys were all there, and then, you know, we had Binder to front, Tobo was there going forward, and then suddenly Arbarino's bike quits. I mean, when's the last time you've seen a Honda just have a problem with it? And from the onboard, it didn't sound like it seized, didn't sound like it held a piston. It just sounded like literally like the electronics turned off and there was no more spark on that bike. So I thought that was rather interesting because that just doesn't happen nowadays. And it actually happened to two Honda guys. It actually happened to Arbarino, and then it happened to
Della Porta, right?
Yes, Della Porta. I think Della Porta actually went first. Sorry, Della Porta had that problem first. And about three laps later, Arbarino had essentially the exact same problem. So two different teams with essentially the same bike having the weird problem like that. I don't know if they just got a bum ignition box, ECU, frayed a wire, not too sure what the deal was with that, but definitely that was bizarre to add to the list of people who were not finishing the race. And then I'll get on my soapbox here with this one, Derek, and I, you know, feel free to chime in anywhere. But as these guys were drafting down the main front straightaway, when they would clear the pit wall, so many of them were cutting across and using the pit lane exit. They were a good 5 to 6 feet beyond, you know, where the end of the racetrack was, so to speak. And I think that that's got to stop because somebody's going to, you know, get pinched or be behind in a draft and think that there might be a little bit more room to the inside, and they're going to pull out and suddenly be on the grass at 140 miles an hour on slicks. And I just think that we got to do something about it. Like, race direction should paint a dotted line that represents where the end of the main straightaway is and say, hey, look, guys, this line represents out of bounds. If you go there, you get the long lap penalty because this is, I mean, I was really scared somebody was going to get really crazy in that area. But luckily, yeah, everybody didn't.
I don't think it's going to be a problem until it's a problem, you know?
It's part of
racing in those small displacement classes. Like, I mean, even thinking back just last week to the Super Sport 300 race in Jerez, those guys were on the back straight. I think one of them ended up going off the circuit because he just was pushed off the circuit, basically. So I definitely understand the concern, but I don't think it's really going to be a problem in their eyes until it becomes a problem just due to the nature and aggression that those riders have. Like, they have to do every little thing to get an advantage. And so they're using all the track. So unless race direction says no, I don't think it's going to stop. And while I agree with you, it's scary, I don't think they're doing anything wrong, you know?
Two points that you made that I'd like to touch on during that. The 300 race, I saw that race, and there's a big difference about being pushed out there and willingly going there.
It was It was more of just the lines they were taking, because all they were all right. So Jerez, you have the back straight, and then you have the Danny Pedrosa corner, so tight right hander, and they were all kind of weaving back and forth to stop the other ones from taking the line. So a lot of them would cut all the way to the right and basically end up getting nudged out at that point, right?
Sure.
So I think it's pretty similar to a degree to your going and trying to create the line that's most effective for you to get the line and exit that you want from the corner.
True. I agree with you. You know, this at Barcelona was much farther along on a straightaway that at that point you really need to be heading back to the other side of the track to set yourself up for the corner. And to me, no one pushed anyone into the pit lane. People just rode over there willingly to take an advantage. The other thing that you said is like, well, there's track limits. Well, is the pit lane really the racetrack? And to me, that's a no. And they shouldn't be not there. I have no problem with anybody riding.
Is it in the rule book?
You know, that's a good question. I cannot answer that one. But it's one of these things where you can kind of.
Unless it's in the rule book, they're not breaking the rules, right?
But, okay. That's very true. That's very, very true. But to me, it's sort of like this whole dilly-dallying on the racing line and qualifying that these guys were doing. Well, okay, they decided to break it into two sessions of 15 minutes so that we wouldn't have this problem. Yet we still sort of have the problem. Here's something that you can look at and realize that it is very black and it's very white, and there's a very defined line that you can say, hey, you do not cross this, and if you do, here's what your penalty is going to be. There's no gray. I don't care if you're bumped there, pushed there, or willingly ride there. You're taking a long lap, which, you know, it's just one of those things where, like you said, it's not going to be a problem until it's a problem. But when it's a problem, then it's really hard to pull it back in and rein everybody in. So I'd rather see something done now as opposed to later, because I'm not trying to be a safety advocate, but I don't want to see anybody get hurt because of that. That's just where I'm standing.
Fair. Yeah, that makes total sense.
So as the racing continues, the crashing continues. Moscia went down. Bender was so close when Moscia lost it. Moscia goes by and just misses the back of Bender's rear tire. That could have been two more guys down, and that would have been really bad. Then Misaki fell off. He went down as well. He tagged the back of Ramirez, and Canet then just barely squeaks by. On that, this kid this year, Cannon, has been riding so well, and he has luck on his side, which sometimes you got to have that racing luck to win races and be in the position that he's in. Toba went to the front. He was leading. Bender and Rodriguez, they went down at turn 10. That was the trouble spot all weekend. Everybody was down at turn 10. It was just a crash fest there. Then we finally got to the last lap of the race. You had Toba, Canet, Lopez, Ramirez, and McPhee. You're trying to figure out who's going to draft who. Toba then went down at turn 10, and he lost the front. He was pushing just that little too much to try to stay out front, to try to win the race. He didn't. McPhee was going to take a run at it as well. He had a great run, but he did have a back end come around. He almost high-sided it. I think that was at the turn 10 area as well. And if you saw the long shot of it, it was very reminiscent of Randy Mamola back in the 80s, where he was off the bike, on the bike, and then walking alongside the bike and finally hops back on it to finish. And that sort of was McPhee doing his best Randy Mamola imitation. But Ramirez came through for the win. It was the first time that he had won it. Canet was second, followed by Vietti, and then Lopez, Foggia, Agüero, Fanati having a fairly decent race. There's a guy that I would have expected a lot more out of, but we're not seeing it. Sasaki 8th, Yamakana 9th, and Kornfeld finished out in 10th.
Yeah, like you mentioned with Fanati, it's interesting to see the struggles that he's had, because it's kind of been consistent for the last couple of races, and he's crashed out of a bunch of them, but he's always, I mean, this has probably been his best finish in in the past couple races, if not this season, I'm not sure.
Yep.
But he's always kind of in that like 10th, 13th, and he's starting to do good lap times, and you're like, okay, great, he's on his way. Like, he's going to make a charge towards the front, and nothing.
Yeah.
So that's always an interesting one. But yeah, it was a true Moto 3 ending. It was great. Especially that turn 10 with McPhee going up and over the handlebars. It was a great save.
Yeah, probably save of the year right now.
It was quite impressive.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was nice. It's also nice to see the variety of Moto 3 too, right?
Sure.
You have Ramirez. I think this is like his first.
Yep, it was his first win.
Really good weekend. It's not his first win, is it?
I thought he won.
When he was on the Bester Capital Dubai team. Anyway.
It was his first win this year then. I know that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, because there's seven different winners in seven races or something.
Yeah,
so it's great. There's variety.
Mm-hmm. You truly don't know who's going to win.
And it makes it like actually exciting because it's close racing. You don't know who's going to win. And it's unpredictable, and that's what you want out of racing. I think that's why we're in a somewhat golden age of motorcycle racing. I was just about to say MotoGP, but you kind of know who's going to win. but yeah, I think at least in MotoGP, there's a lot more competition. It's not just two factories now.
Yep.
But yeah, you get what I mean. I think Moto3 has and always has embodied, you know, really close, tight racing, and it's always fun to watch. So
it was entertaining. There's no question about that.
I will say definitely the best race of the weekend, in my opinion, as we continue on.
Yeah, I agree.
Just from a outright racing and spectator perspective, like, this was definitely the best one.
I always judge a race by my notations. And I had more notes for Moto3 than I had for anything else. So that was the best race of the weekend, just based on that alone.
Yeah, yeah. always a lot happening. But yeah, anything else you want to add on Moto3 before we
I just want to look at the championship standings. With his second place, Aaron Canet has now went out and has a 23-point lead over Della Porta. You know, Canet took advantage of everybody's problems. Della Porta had the engine failure. Antonelli had a crash. And then, you know, it's just he's now essentially one race win in front, which is great for him. He's been super consistent. The bike has been good. He's been good. And you could tell this race, he wanted to make sure that he was a little closer to the front than he has been in the other races. He's kind of fallen back a little too far. I think he's realized that mistake and needs to understand he needs to be in that top 5-6 area and hang right there, conserve his tires, and go with it. But I do think now, where we are now, it is definitely Canet has looked good in the championship. I think he's probably the man to beat in the championship. Is the championship over? No way. All he needs to do is have one mistake, fall off, get caught in a crash in a lead pack, which could have so easily happened to him this weekend. He did barely miss out and did barely miss Ramirez's bike. And that 23 point lead will be a 22-20 will become a 3-point lead. So that's where it's going to be. But it's going to be, I think it's safe to say it's between Canet, Della Porta, and Antonelli for the championship this year.
Yeah, in all honesty, like with the other classes, you know, I'm really thinking about championship and, you know, that chess game. But Moto3, like it's really just about who. Each race is so exciting, and I'm like not even looking at the championship yet. You know, I think Canet, like you said, he's the man to beat, and this is the first year, and probably this is the third year he's been a contender, and the first year that he seems like he's putting together consistent results. So,
yep.
Yeah, I think he's the man to beat. I think Della Porta's not punching above his weight, but I think he's been more consistent than than before, and it's nice to see that, I guess. So that's cool. Antonelli, nice to see him also giving some consistency, but you know, you gotta be on the podium or in the top five every week. And that's something that they're, well, Della Porta was doing, and to no fault of his own, but
yeah, anyway. Della, that's the one I feel sorry. It was a bike failure. He had no control over that at all. And you know, you could see it when he came into the pits with the bike, and the crew, you know, they grabbed the bike from him, they came up, they grabbed him, they gave him a big hug, you know, they kind of, you know, gave him the good pat on the back, like, hey bud, we let you down here. And they, you know, that's how you gotta be, and I liked seeing that.
Yeah, so anyway, on to Moto 2,
where
there was a new pole sitter to qualifying, Augusto Fernandez.
Yes.
He's looked strong all year, and he kind of got a toe from Baldessari. Mm-hmm. So it all ended up working out. He sat on pole position. Tom Lüdi put together a good fast lap. He's, again, normally not a super fast qualifier, but he was second. I think they said he's only had like 12 pole positions or something. Some like ridiculously low number for how good and consistent he is.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so he started on the front row. Sam Lowe's in third, which gave some hope to his weekend.
Well, Lowe's was interesting. Lowe's was interesting because everybody had set a fast time by about halfway through that 15-minute qualifying session. The only person who really changed his position was Lowe's at the final dying minutes, and he jumped up to third. So it was like great to see, but in the back of your mind, when you kind of just jump up, you think, did he just grab that bike, ride it by the scruff of the neck, and just throw in a great lap and got lucky? And I was thinking that anyway, and like, well, let's see what happens in the race.
Yeah. In all honesty, I haven't, as much as I want to see Lowe's do well and kind of redeem his poor MotoGP season, it just hasn't been happening in the past year and a half now. So I didn't have my hopes up too much, unfortunately.
Yep.
I did have my hopes up for Jorge Navarro in fourth. He's been really good the past couple of races. And then Digi Antonio in fifth, which was a fantastic qualifying. I think that it's nice to see the speed up as competitive as it is this year with the new engine.
Mm-hmm.
It's unfortunate that KTM isn't also up there, so we don't have multiple manufacturers fighting for wins and podiums. More than two manufacturers fighting for wins and podiums. But it's also nice to see a rookie do well. I mean, Digi Antonio and also Bastianini have been doing very, very well this year.
Mm-hmm.
But again, just qualifying. We'll get into the races.
So
Alex Marquez rounds out the second row. Baldessari, the points leader going into this round, was in seventh. Buliga, solid eighth. And
Locatelli was ninth.
Okay. Yeah, and Locatelli was ninth. So, yeah, that was that. And on to the race.
Well, can I add one quick thing?
Please do.
So you look down the list of who's qualified where, and Chavez Vierge is nowhere to be found. And I'm wondering what's going on, because here's a guy who was riding the Tech 3 Mistral and pretty much was riding the wheels off of that bike, kind of made a name for himself in the paddock. He went from Tech 3 to Dynavolt on a Kalex, got onto the front row a few times. He had a few pole positions with Dynavolt. He was the coming man, if you will. He looked great. He then, you know, we thought Dynavolt had a few problems with the team. They had a fuel pump problem, I know, for one on his bike. And he was able to then get a ride with with Mark VDS, who is probably one of the premier teams in Moto 2. Yet Verhey can't seem to come to grips with this Triumph motor or something in there. And I'm just wondering what happened to him, because he's really not even been anywhere near the front at all.
Yeah, I think changing the engine changes the characteristic of the bike, and some people have been able to adapt and some people haven't. I think Luca Marini is a good example. I think he's part of his thing was an injury. but I think also adapting to that a new writing style, you know, it didn't come so fluid for some as it has for others. So I think that has a lot to do with it, because as Alex Marquez has shown the past two rounds previously, the Mark BDS team is back to being one of, if not the strongest bike and team on the Moto2 grid. So we don't have that excuse of kind of internal woes in the team this year. Mm-hmm. So I think all those changes and then the change to the bike, and I think this race too, he showed that there was progress that's been made. So
fair enough. I'll take it. It's just one of those ones where you look at it and you think, well, you know, we used to talk about him all the time and now we're not talking about him. So kind of trying to figure out, like, you know, the what happened part of it. But let's get to the race.
Yeah. So Ludi got the whole shot. He was doing good. It was a strange one.
Mm-hmm.
Because Fernandez and Ludi kind of took off there. And they had a pretty big gap at one point.
They did, yeah.
It was mm-hmm. like a second, a second and a half. So that was good. And Baldassare didn't get a great start. Marquez didn't get a great start. So the field kind of stretched out a little bit. And you're like, oh, this is going to be like classic Moto2 when you could nap and then wake up at the end of the race. And it was kind of still the same. And it wasn't that bad because eventually Ludi and Fernandez's pace kind of died down, and Marquez just made a charge forward. He saw that he was going to be able to close in the gap, and he did exactly that. And then Fernandez's pace dropped off, and Ludi was right on Marquez for quite some time at the front. And then it became a true Moto2 snoozer when that happened. Yeah, so eventually Alex Marquez wins. Tom Ludi, I think the last couple laps kind of rolls off a bit. Navarro comes up to third after Fernandez's pace kind of drops off. There was some attrition to the race, though. You had Baldassare make a huge mistake in not only turn 10 where he crashed, but earlier in the race, I think on the first or second lap, he basically took Remy Gardner out.
Yeah.
He ran so wide.
That was a scary crash.
It was, because you could see Remy just totally locked up the front brake and then basically just flipped.
Mm-hmm.
And the first couple replays they showed, you're like, oh, Remy just like got in there too hot. Like, he screwed up.
Yeah, and he rode up the back of Baldassare, but if you watch, that's not really what happens.
Yeah, if you watch Baldassare's onboard, it gives a much better picture of what happens, because Baldassare just screws the corner up. He gets in there so hot, and then he has to run so wide. He was in there and had nowhere to go, and he basically pushed him off the track. Mm-hmm. So that sucked for Remy, because he's still coming back from a big collarbone injury. The bike landed on top of him.
Yeah, that was scary, because foot pegs and handlebars have a tendency to create puncture wounds.
Yeah, so that was pretty scary. He seemed okay to a degree, but, I mean, to have a freaking motorcycle fall on you with a broken collarbone, see how it's going to feel.
What are those things? Like, the Moto2 bikes are, what, like close to 300 pounds? I think it's there.
I'm good with Celsius to Fahrenheit conversion. I'm good with dollar to euro conversion. I can't do kilograms to pounds. I'm not there yet. I don't have it dialed.
Take kilograms and multiply by two. That's a cheater way to get out of it.
I don't think it works up when you get it up until like the 200-300 kilos, because then you're just too far off. But anyway, please someone write in and tell us how dumb Americans we are and that we don't use the metric system. And please tell us how much those Moto2 bikes weigh, because I think we should be on the metric system, but that's neither here nor there. Basically, just so I can understand my motorsports when I watch them. That's really the only reason that I'm looking for it. So that was a scary crash. Baldassare made it. He went in too hot in turn 10, crashed out, and ruined his own race. Like, the past, in Coda, it was Martin who ran in the back of him. What other race did he crash out of? Le Mans?
Did
he get taken out at Le Mans?
I believe so,
no,
yes.
No, Le Mans, he had a fourth. I don't know what I'm talking about.
Well, like Skylar and I, we can't remember seven months ago, less alone 7 days ago, 14 days ago, to what happened where. But
he's had three DNFs. Most of them haven't been his fault, but this one was just a total unforced error. He just went so hot into turn 10. But to be fair, as most of the commentary has outlined, that corner looks like it sucks. You know, yes. It ruins that classic flowing nature of the track, and we saw incidents there all weekend. Mm-hmm. And that's really the only place that we saw major incidents happen.
Yeah,
so
I agree.
But yeah, so Baldessari kind of he screwed himself there.
Mm-hmm.
So that was interesting.
I thought Marquez's ride was interesting.
Yeah,
somehow
he had a very calculated ride.
Yeah,
you know?
That was what I was going to say. His ride was really calculated. He looked completely in control. He didn't let anything around him faze him. You know, he did notice that Luthi and Fernandez were kind of getting away a little bit at the front. So he picked up his pace, got there, picked them off, and rode smart, smooth, controlled. This is a very different Alex Marquez than what we've seen the past couple of years.
He's
matured.
I don't want to say he's doing the Marquez and just kind of picking up the points, but like literally no move that he made was without reason. Every move was thought out.
Yeah.
And he knew he could make the pass. He knew he could make it stick. He didn't look like he was doing anything crazy, which was very interesting to see. Yeah. I mean, that's how you win championships. You win championships with three in a row,
mm-hmm.
Three wins in a row. And then the next weekend when everything isn't working out so well, you're still fourth or fifth, you know?
Yep.
Obviously he knows from his brother, you know, consistency. His brother is just always on the podium. But
or he crashes.
In Moto 2, that's not always going to happen. So, I think it was an incredibly intelligent ride by him this weekend. And while I'm not a huge fan of the Marquez dynasty that's happening, you have to give the credit to him because it was really well, especially what, like 2-3 years ago, he was just crashing out every single weekend.
Yep.
And now he's not trying to make moves that aren't there. It was on top of that, it was against Mr. Consistency, Tom Ludi, with all the experience in the world. So it's not like he was just waiting for someone to make a mistake. Like maybe he could have been with Fernandez. Like he took on the best of the best there. But I think also Ludi, you have to give it to him. Still, I think he's second in the championship now.
Yep.
Second in the championship, less than 10 points behind. Mm-hmm. So I think if Baldessari can start taking wins and start battling with Marquez and Navarro also, If they can kind of stop his winning streak, it can be very interesting for the rest of the season in terms of the championship, like we're talking about with Moto3. I think this championship as well is wide open, but yeah, it's going to depend on results from the top four. You know, right? We got Marquez, Ludi, Navarro, who's been doing very well in the speed up, and Baldessari. And I think you can have some wild cards, like maybe Schroeder can win that race this season. And actually kind of looking at the names on the list, that's really the only one that I'm seeing that could
I wouldn't
maybe
be surprised if Gardner doesn't win one.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I'm not going to go on the limb and say Gardner does win one, but
yes.
The way he started at the beginning of the year, the way he looked like in Argentina, he looked like he had the speed, the confidence, and something was going to happen. Now it's been bad luck. He's been down a couple of races. He had the collarbone injury. None of that was actually his. Well, okay, yeah, Jerez was his doing. You know, he got it on it. But, you know.
But yeah,
it's a possibility. You know, it's a possibility.
Yeah. If he can get back to the confidence that he had at the beginning of the season, he's competitive enough as a rider to stir things up at the front. But I think it's just going to be down to him getting healthy. Yeah. I think that was his issue last year too. He had two broken legs at one point after a motocross accident. So he was always coming back, and so hopefully he can get to 100% fitness and mix it up in the front. But yeah, Marquez, Ludi, Baldessari, I think that's going to be.
Yeah, Navarro has definitely got a big shot at it.
I don't think Navarro necessarily has a shot at the championship, but I really? Think he has a shot to mix things up and make things interesting. I think he can be a big catalyst.
I think Navarro has a shot, personally. That's my take. He's been at the front, rode well. He needs to make a little better start and might be there. But the speed up's a good chassis, and he's, you know, he's right there with everybody, so we'll see what happens. That's the one thing about Marquez with Luthi. You know, Luthi used up his tires, and I thought Marquez had used up his tires to catch Luthi at the very beginning. I thought Marquez was running laps at a pace that he could not sustain over that whole entire distance, yet he did, which shows that Alex has either got the setup really dialed in on that Kalex, or he's figured out how to ride in some manner in which he's not taxing the tire as much as everybody else is. And that's a really great spot to be in if you're Alex Marquez. If you're beating Luthi, who is very smooth, easy on the tire, and you have more tire and more life left that you can run that pace, higher pace, more consistently throughout the race, that's a dangerous combination to have. So... it's another, you know, yes. Kudos to Marquez. I know you're not the Marquez fan and whatnot, but I mean, you had to give the kid credit. Three in a row.
For
and
sure.
He did all three of them. He did the last two of them were from behind. You know, he definitely worked his way to the front to get there, and can't fault him at all. So that's Moto 2.
One thing we'll touch on real quick, Moto 2, before we go to MotoGP. Is again the KTM woes continue. They said it's gonna be not until Bruno that they have something new to try. Just such a shame for Binder, more than anyone else. Like, obviously there's a lot of people in KTM because they hope they were going to be competitive, but you know, that's what makes up the back of the field. So we'll continue looking at that story. I don't think there's really anything to talk about that's new, but it's again, it's kind of sad to see. But that's Moto 2, and now on to MotoGP.
On the MotoGP. So in MotoGP, you had the first.
Right. Let's cut the crap. Let's get right to the meat and potatoes. Crash. I'm not even worried about qualifying.
All right. You're not worried about the fact that Quartararo was on pole again?
No.
Okay.
Not worried about that.
Not worried about it. Okay.
Amazing.
Right. You go for it then.
But it is the crash. It's the talking point of the race, and it really determined kind of the whole weekend for a lot of people, Quartararo included, right?
Yeah.
I think let's go to our talking points that we kind of had up here.
Should we just kind of talk through the crash?
Okay, let's talk through the crash.
Just so everybody's caught up to like what we're talking about.
Yeah, because everyone's like, all right, we've been listening to the show for like an hour. Can we just get to the crash, please? So
thank you for hanging in there, loyal listeners, as we mutter our way through to it. So what were we on the...
Second lap of the race.
Third lap. Lorenzo, who had started well down the grid, has an absolute blinder of a start along with Dovizioso. And those two guys are at or near the front. And to see Lorenzo at the front, that close to the front, was amazing. So we're getting to turn 10, the infamous turn 10 where everybody's crashed. Basically, Lorenzo goes in there. He's online, but Marquez has basically sat up Dovizioso with his pass. So Dovi changes his break point, takes a little bit more break, changes his apex point to go to the under to try to get back under Marquez. Well, that space had been taken up by Dovi that Lorenzo was actually looking for. Lorenzo then pulls on a little more front brake. He loses the front. He slams into Dovizioso, knocks him down. Dovizioso's bike then takes down Maverick Vinales, who was trying to ride around the outside, And then as the calamity ensues and everything slides off the track, Rossi has nowhere to go. He's trying to avoid the down bike of Lorenzo. He can't, and Lorenzo's spinning bike spins back around. Rossi bunny hops over that front tire and crashes into it. So four guys down, one of them a championship contender, gone at the infamous turn 10. That's where we are. So
yes,
Derek,
thank you for the play-by-play.
Go for it. Just so we all know where we are.
Yeah. So like you said, Lorenzo was up front. He got a very Lorenzo start, which was great to see. And I was excited, right? Because I thought he was going to be battling.
I thought it was awesome, too.
I thought it was awesome, too. It was great to see him up there and possibly competitive. But I think there's a couple key things to this incident, right? One is that Dovizioso had a moment on the rear going at the start of that back straight. If he didn't have that moment, he would have been in front, and Mark most likely would have been the guy getting taken out. So that's one thing that I saw and I was just like, ugh. But you can't, I don't know, like, I want to be mad at Lorenzo, but I can't be. He wasn't out of control.
Nope.
He made a mistake at the worst corner on the entire track that everyone has had moments in this weekend. It was just like, it goes back to that conversation that we've had about everyone, because the field is so close and because all the times are so tight, especially at the beginning of the race when everything's even more bunched up, is that because everything's so close, if someone goes down, there's going to be a domino effect, and that's exactly what we saw here. And it's unfortunate. I don't want to say it's a racing incident necessarily, because it was totally Lorenzo's fault. I don't think, you know, people are like, oh, he should get penalized. He was crazy, ruined everything. Like, yeah, he screwed up the Vitiosa's championship big time. But I don't think he should be penalized. It was a mistake at a difficult corner, and he just happened to knock three other riders out, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my take on it. It sucks. And it was Jerez last year all over again, but I don't know. It was a racing. It's racing.
Yeah. And you know, here, I'll throw this in here. I don't know. Anyone on Twitter, if you follow Ben Spies had a very, very awesome tweet that he threw out there. It is a picture of Donington Park back in 1994. And it's when Mick Doohan was there getting to the, they call it the Fogarty S's now, where before you go into the Melbourne Loop. But Mick Doohan screwed up, went up the inside, he crashed on the front. And Daryl Beattie's on the ground. Luca Cadalora is getting ready to go on the ground. And Schwantz is basically upside down in this picture. And Ben Spies says, happens to the best of them. Only this one, you didn't have to read all the crap comments, you know, complaining that back in 1994, you didn't have the Twitter, you didn't have the social media outrage. He says, have perspective. These riders and the ones Sunday all have cleaned people out at some point. Y'all wanted tight racing, and now it is. And the best was the reply from Dennis Noyes to it. He said, yes, that is the best example of the difference between now and then. I was there at trackside and in the media center. No one suggested that Mick Doohan, who had not won a title yet, deserves sanction. I can't think of any rider who hasn't taken someone down. And that's the truth. Here's the deal. We've come up with a set of rules now everybody's got to have a certain bore and certain stroke. So the engines can only rev so high. You can't really do any trickery. We've gone to, in that respect, you've gone to a standardized ECU, standardized IMUs. You've given them basically traction control, and that's about it. And it's tepid at most, right? You're on a control tire that everybody's got one manufacturer of, and the difference between the hard, the soft, and the medium is very small over a race distance. Consequently, you have now grouped everybody into a pack, and mistakes are going to happen. And just because everybody's so close together, when a mistake does happen, boom, you knock down three or four riders. everybody was tired of seeing Lorenzo run off and hide at different races, so we had to change the rules. Or people were getting tired of seeing Marquez run off on a Honda, or whatever it was that everybody was all mad about. This is the rules that we got. This is the racing that we have. It was a racing incident. You know, it would be completely different to me if Lorenzo, you know, came out and didn't apologize at all. Yet he did. He actually did something I thought was brave. He manned up. He talked to Simon Crafar and said, "I'm sorry." Leave it, people.
I don't know if the apology justifies it.
But no. I'm not saying it does. No.
The biggest thing was his riding, right? Like he wasn't out of control. He wasn't riding outside of his limits. You know, it wasn't like what riders. Marco Simoncelli is a great example, right?
Yeah, Marcelli,
a great example.
Yeah, they push boundaries. There's no question. Those two push boundaries. Yeah. All right,
which
give you that.
Ultimately deserved, and you could tell they were riding outside of their limit.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Agreed.
Whereas Lorenzo wasn't. He was
not at all.
Which I want to be. It's frustrating for me as a fan. It's like, oh, you want to be mad at someone, but it's like, no, man, like. He made a mistake. Like I think I didn't see that tweet by Ben Spies, but that sounds absolutely perfect, right? Like
yeah.
Everyone's made mistakes like that. And that's what happens with close racing. Mm-hmm. That's what we signed up for here, which is great, but the rest of the race was a snoozer. You know, Marquez leads. There was some good moves for second and third between Rins, Petrucci, and Quartararo, but at the end of the day, like the writing was on the wall with a lot of those moves. Right. So we had Petrucci in second for a while. Rins, same old story. Couldn't get by him. When he did get by him, Petrucci would just come back on the straight.
Yep.
Rins just burned up his tires doing that. And then eventually Petrucci burned up his tires because that's just the nature of Petrucci. And he had to defend, and the grip and the track surface seemed to be causing a lot of issues as well. And Quartararo made the most of it. So hats off to him. Like you said, he had arm pump surgery just a couple days before. And then he comes, gets pole position, and has his first podium. So that was nice to see. But again, it wasn't exciting the way a race should be. The way we've kind of been spoiled with races in the not so distant.
I don't think we're going to be disappointed at Aston.
2 weeks? Dude, Aston has to be the best race of the year. If last year's anything to go by,
I know.
With the even more competitive Suzuki.
But we're ahead of ourselves. But yeah, yes.
Just a little
yes.
bit. But, no,
but you're right.
I think,
you're right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'm very excited for Aston.
It's going to be amazing. But,
and I think we were ultimately robbed of a very interesting race here. Because
yeah.
I think Barcelona could have been just as interesting as Mugello because the grip was so low. And yeah. If Dovi got out in front, he would have done his, you know, wait behind me and then take off. And those races are always interesting to see how the rest of the field plays it.
Yeah. I'm not going to say that it wouldn't have been a great race if we didn't have the accident. I think it would have been an amazing battle. However, if you look at Marquez, his race pace times that he had probably more race pace than anybody else on the grid.
But that happens. That happens.
And you can still not win
a lot of the time.
And you can still not win. But I don't know if it would have been different because, given the fact that you had turn 10 there, if Dovizioso was leading,
I don't want to play that game, right?
I don't want to either.
It's all race pace in free practice.
Sure.
Like it gives a good indication of what race pace may be, but I'd say, you know, like what, 75% of the time, like the race pace someone had on Saturday, someone makes a change and they find something, or the field is bunched up or something happens. And unless Mark is doing like half a second faster that he does in like Argentina in the Saxon ring, I'm not a fan of looking at the race pace to see who's going to be super competitive, because I think at this point it really does boil down to if Mark or Dovi is having a good day, or if Petrucci decides to have a good day, or if Rins can get by someone and stay in front. There's so many factors.
True.
But I can appreciate where you're going with it, and I appreciate crunching the numbers, but it's...
I'm an engineer. Leave me alone.
Yeah, it's like, but, like Rossi can make stuff happen on Sunday. You know, sure. It's like you can't account for everything.
So does Rins. Rins doesn't qualify well, and Rins makes things happen on Sunday too. Yeah. Same so thing. I'm truly
devastated for Rins week out, because if he could just get by them for like four corners, that's all he needs.
Yeah. It's just the wrong tracks. I mean, he's got a great shot at Sachsenring if he qualifies well.
That's one thing I'm interested to see this year. If Mark can truly dominate at Sachsenring with Rins as competitive as he is on those smaller tracks.
Mm-hmm. So
I don't know if it's going to change. I mean, Mark's just dominated the Sachsenring. What's like 7 or 8 years in a row?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. I'm not going to hold my breath. But no. I'm hoping that Rins can do something.
I think you would agree with me on this. At a track like Barcelona with the long straightaway, I think you would agree that the Ducati and the Honda would have been at the front no matter what.
For sure.
That was a guaranteed. We were going to see Marquez. We were going to see Dovi. Probably Petrucci there. Rins as well. Throw in a Yamaha. Take your pick. Whoever you want it. Knowing that, if Dovi was playing a back him up kind of a strategy in putting, if you will, through the first part of the race until they got to the end where he kind of opens the Ducati up and tries to use the Ducati horsepower. Knowing that that turn 10 is there, I guarantee you Marquez would have took a shot at him. There's no way Mark would have never done that. And Mark may have made the pass and Dovi may have got back under, but that's ifs and buts and candy and nuts, and we'd all have a very Merry Christmas. But it's a turn 10 is the problem, right? I think even Rossi said this. He said, I don't understand why we have turn 10. It's a supermarket parking lot of a corner. It's the Formula One turn 10 that we're using at the circuit. Now, if anybody was paying any attention at all, we know that we went through having Luis Salom run off at the turn. What was that? That would be turn
so the final
13,
corner, right?
No, just before that. 14 is the final one. 13 is
it's like the double apex, right?
The big double apex, right? So yeah. He ran off. There wasn't enough runoff area. Unfortunately, Luis Salom succumbed to injuries that he had there. Okay, so they spent a whole. So for the couple of years we've been running through the Formula One turn 10, we'll call that, and through the Formula One chicanes at the end of the lap. The circuit went through a big reconstruction. They did a lot of money. They moved a lot of barriers, bleachers, stands, whatever. They created a huge amount of runoff area, and they went back and said, hey, we're going to run the old classic circuit and have the two big sweeping corners at the end of the lap for the motorcycles. But yet they still didn't let us go back to the original turn 10, which is a more swooping inside kind of a corner and not a bend back on yourself kind of a corner. If we'd been running that circuit, I don't think Lorenzo would have crashed, because you have more flow. You carry more corner speed through that other configuration. So,
I mean, even in that configuration, there were a lot of crashes.
In every class. In every class. Which goes to show, it's also, and I apologize to people who can't see this, but the video that was shot by Dave that he sent in to us, that is actually quite steeply downhill to that point. It's a little steeper than what you think it is. The, you know, I know it goes downhill, but seeing all the camera angles that they show us on the television feed flattens that out a whole lot more than what it really is. And his perspective where he was, you could see sort of how the walls are canted in the pictures. And right as you're breaking down, you get to a spot where then it goes flat and suddenly you're having to turn. Now you're asking the front tire of that bike to do three things. You're trying to get it to hold up with the suspension while you're underneath heavy braking. You're then asking the suspension to keep from completely collapsing because you're bottoming it out with the brakes. And then just the physical force of running from a downhill section to a flat section, you know, essentially a bump, if you will, that's pushing the suspension even more. Now the front tire's got to cope with the fact that you want to lean the bike into an incredibly hard left-hand corner. You're just not going to have grip there. You can get a tire to do two things well. You can't get it to do three things well at the same time. It just isn't going to happen. So I don't know why we're using that chicane, but that's part of it. Part of it is just simply that the track and how it's designed, how it's laid out. You know, that might be a perfectly fine corner for Formula One cars with big wide tires and super amounts of grip and wings that push them into the ground. It isn't what you need for a motorcycle, and I think we need to go back to the older circuit.
All right, Jim, question for you.
Sure. Lay it on me.
2020, we're supposed to have the Kimi Ring, right? Finland?
Yeah.
A couple of years after that, or possibly a year after that, we got a race in Indonesia coming up.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be a race that goes.
Right. Okay. Which race goes away?
Three Spanish Grand Prix.
Yep. Three races in Spain. Yep. Which one goes, right? That's the question.
Which one goes?
Valencia.
I don't think it does. I think
really
there's been so many problems with Barcelona.
I would take Barcelona because I think the racing's better there.
Is it though?
I think it is. I mean,
I think it's a question to ask.
It's a yes. Okay, you definitely okay. Let's do this by process of elimination. I think Aragon stays.
There's four races in Spain. There's Aragon too, right?
Oh, Jerez. Yeah, we got Jerez too. Sorry, four. Yeah. No. So I would venture that Aragon has to stay.
Aragon has to stay. Jerez has to stay. I think it's between those Valencia and Barcelona.
So,
but
how about this for a compromise? What if they went every other year? Like even years you're in Valencia, odd years you're in Barcelona.
I mean, I'm not here to make the compromise, but no, I'm just saying between the tracks that are on the chopping block and the problems that they're having, I think it'd be interesting to not go to Barcelona just because I'm happy to talk about on track drama and excitement, but not when in every class it's just down
crash
to one
fest.
Corner being crappy, you know?
Yeah.
So, but I also understand why they don't want to use the longer loop because at the speeds they're going, if they can't slow down, there's nowhere near as much runoff as they need.
Sure.
If you like look at the track map, like mm-hmm. there's not a lot of gravel, and
no.
bikes were getting to the end of the fence pretty regularly. So
yeah.
I understand that from a safety perspective. But
you are so right with that because did you see any of the pictures from testing?
Is that the corner Lorenzo went down in?
He went down at 9, which is the preceding corner.
Yeah, okay.
But still, your point is that the bikes are moving really fast and there's not enough gravel. Lorenzo fell off at 9, and that bike wound up on top of the tire barrier.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, so your point is completely valid.
Yeah.
With that.
So I don't know. Think about. I have no idea if it's going to happen. I think Barcelona was a bigger race than it is now, just because of the things that have happened there and the configurations that they've tried to run the track at. And I don't think there's a good enough compromise. As much as that final corner is great, I don't think the safety there for a Grand Prix track, you know, it's like
right.
if that's safe enough, then go to Laguna, you know, it's like Laguna has other problems than track safety.
Sure.
But just from a track standpoint, like if that's safe enough, then Laguna's safe enough.
Agreed.
So I don't know.
Really,
if
I had my wish, I'd ixnay Valencia and Barcelona because I'd take the race from Valencia and put it at Portimao. And call it the Spanish Grand Prix.
I wouldn't call it. It's not in Spain. But,
I know it's not. I know.
Yeah,
I know it's not.
Be
I know it's
amazing.
In Portugal.
But again, that doesn't meet the MotoGP homologation either. So it's like.
Yeah. I know. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Agreed with all of that. But yeah. So that was MotoGP crash fest and a bit of the same old, which was a little unfortunate. But like Jim mentioned, we're going to Assen next, and that is going to be exciting many reasons.
You know, but you know, I look at Assen and I look at some of the corners there and think there's not enough runoff there either. But yet they go and they race there, and that is a lot higher speed through a lot of sections there at Assen than it is at Barcelona. So you know, it's every track's different, every runoff's different. I've never personally been to or seen those tracks to know, you know, track max.
I don't know. I think Assen does, right? Especially, I think if you look at the approaches of the corners, there's plenty.
That might be the true issue.
Just looking at the, like, where the track is in relation to the track, it's very close. But if you look at the approach of the corner, there's tons of room. Like, I mean, think about the famous Lorenzo incident, right?
That's true.
Where he just goes and he slides forever.
Yeah.
And there's nothing. So, anyway.
Good point.
So let's to round it off. We got Marquez leading the championship with at 140 points. Very costly to Dovi in second now at 103. Rins moves up to third at 101. Petrucci at 98. And Rossi in fifth with 72, which is didn't expect that. Didn't realize he was so high up in the championship.
Rossi's had some good rides. No question about that.
So yeah, that's all she wrote as far as MotoGP goes.
Works for me. All right. Well, I think we've babbled on long enough, and I think we can probably close the show out. So. Hopefully you guys enjoyed this one. I enjoyed doing this one with you, Derek. It was a lot of great talking points. If you want to get in touch with us, you always can leave comments and feedback. You can do it by emailing us at motopod@motopodcast.com. If you want to get in touch with us directly, you can get hold of me. I'm Jim. I'm at MotoRGV on Instagram and Twitter. Derek, if the people want to interact with you, where can they find you?
They can find me at MotoDerekC. Liking and retweeting stuff on Twitter and posting every now and then on Instagram with some motorcycles.
Okay. So that does it for us here. Once again, thanks to everyone for listening to the show, and we will get back to you after Assen. Until then.